Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, President Biden has called Russia's attack on Ukraine a war crime. What does that mean in terms of legal remedies? When and how are war crimes adjudicated? And what does that mean for the millions of survivors and victims? Joining us are four experts. Jennifer Trahan is a professor and director of the Concentration in International Law and Human Rights at NYU's Center for Global Affairs. Trahan has published two digests on the case law of the ad hoc tribunals and is the author of Existing Legal Limits to the Use of the Veto in the Face of Atrocity Crimes. Barbara Rana is a professor at Cardozo Law School and the author of Is There a Way Out of the Non-International Armed Conflict Detention Dilemma? And also State Responsibility to Respect, Protect, and Fulfill Human Rights Obligations in Cyberspace. Rebecca Hamilton is a professor at American University, Washington College of Law, and the author of Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide, and co-author of Social Media Platforms in International Criminal Investigations. Kate McIntosh also joins us. She is the inaugural executive director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA School of Law. She was head of humanitarian affairs for Doctors Without Borders and is the author of How Long Until the Planet's Destruction is an International Crime? And the forthcoming, The Crime of Ecocide Through Human Rights, New Tools for Climate Justice. So welcome to the Scholar Circle, Jennifer Trahan, Gabor Rana, Rebecca Hamilton, and Kate McIntosh. So President Biden has said Vladimir Putin has committed war crimes. We wanted to explore today what exactly that means and, you know, what it means legally and how that has been sort of articulated over time, how it's developed. And Jennifer Trahan, I think you have been somebody who has examined this context, this development context. Could you explain to us how we have gotten to this place in terms of the laws of war and war crimes, how these have developed?
Thank you so much. So war crimes actually has an old pedigree. You see very early traces of it. I think there's reference in one of the plays of Shakespeare. And then we have elaborate codes of war starting at the end of the 1800s. Then the emphasis also really shifts to how do you prosecute the war crimes? And we have developed over the years, starting with the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals, leading to Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and now we're up to the International Criminal Court, and that kind of takes us up to present.
And how did the International Criminal Court actually get established?
So it was actually negotiated by states. They were in Rome, Italy, in the summer of 1998. So its founding treaty is called the Rome Statute. And negotiations on this enormous treaty, and that actually creates the court. The states then ratified the treaty. And the court first started up in 2002. Some of the states joined later. So now we're at 123 states that are parties to the court.
And so, Gabor Rana, let's bring you in. What would you add to this context historically or broader context or legal context to help us understand the laws of war and war crimes?
Thank you, Maria. I spent a number of years working in the legal division of the International Red Cross, which is a humanitarian agency. And so we emphasize kind of philosophical and humanitarian aspects of the development of the notion of war crimes. And from that perspective, I think it's useful to first take note, I don't know, maybe 3,000 years ago, I think it was Cicero who was famous for having said, in war, there is no law. Well, actually, he was wrong then, because even back then, there were customs of law for war. For example, if I agree to surrender, you agree not to kill me. Yes, I agree to that. You know, that's a custom of war. But something very revolutionary happened around 300 years ago when Rousseau wrote Social Contract. He said in the Social Contract that the only legitimate object of war is to weaken the enemy forces. that really changed a lot because all of a sudden, a number of principles grew out of that notion that one had to distinguish between combatants and civilians, that one had to not target civilians, principle of proportionality, even if you're targeting a legitimate military objective, you have to care to minimize civilian harm, you have to avoid unnecessary suffering. And out of these principles grew the rules that became the Geneva Conventions about 150 years ago. So there's a long pedigree to this notion of laws of war and violations of war. Now, what is more recent is the notion that violations of the laws of war are actually criminal.
And when did that develop?
Well, the most important development in connection with that shift was Nuremberg after the Second World War. And that was a case of merely the victors in the Second World War having decided that they wanted to establish a tribunal. The ironic thing today, in light of Russia and Ukraine, at least my understanding is that at the conference among leaders of Russia and Churchill and the United States, the Americans and the Brits were not all that fond of the idea of conducting war crime trials. It was Stalin who thought this would be a good idea. And the reason is Stalin really liked show trials. He was an expert at them. And it was in large part, I think, the emphasis of the Soviets on establishing justice through trials rather than just lining up Nazis and shooting them that resulted in an international notion of responsibility for war crimes.
Wow, that is so fascinating. So it wasn't this big rule of law idea that the United States and the UK brought forward so much as it was show trials.
That eventually turned into international law foundations. And as Jennifer said, the International Criminal Court and many other mechanisms.
Well, I guess the end does matter, no matter where it began.
Right.
So Rebecca Hamilton, what would you add?
I was just going to add to that, that I think the Stalin show trial is part of it, but there's also been some really fascinating work. We just published about this on the Just Security blog about the role of Soviet lawyers who had developed this notion of, you know, war crimes and in particular, the crime of aggression, which is related but different from the war crimes that we're talking about. And who really did the groundwork to lay the legal foundation for that crime against the peace that we saw showing up in Nuremberg. And so, again, I think that is particularly interesting in this moment.
Could you distinguish those, the crime of aggression? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this is maybe tricky for people to get their head around it at first. But the way that I find it most sort of straightforward to describe it is that war crimes are about the crimes that happen once you are in the midst of conflict. And as you said, this long tradition through the Geneva Conventions and before that, governing the rules once you're actually in a conflict. The crime of aggression is about going to war in the first place, resorting to the use of force. And that is something, and we'll get into this in the conversation, but that is the one crime that the International Criminal Court does not have jurisdiction over in this particular conflict between Russia and Ukraine. But Putin's decision to invade, to resort to war, it is an absolute textbook example of the crime of aggression. And so there are a number of us that are very keen to see a forum for that to be prosecuted.
And yet what you're saying is this, it does not fall under the regime now of war crimes, can't be prosecuted in that way. Can it even be in something like the ICC? Well, I guess the ICC has all kinds of other limitations and constraints, but another kind of tribunal.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that now, and it's only really recent, the ICC does in fact have jurisdiction over the crime of aggression, but only for the states that have joined the Rome Treaty that Jennifer was talking about and have agreed specifically that the court can have jurisdiction over this crime of aggression. That unfortunately is not the situation for Russia and Ukraine. And so that's why the court can't get at this particular crime of the decision to go to war in the first place, even though it can prosecute war crimes, genocidal crimes against humanity in this conflict.
Kate McIntosh, what would you add to this?
Thanks, Maria. Wonderful to be here and great to see the other people here with us today. The point that Rebecca just made about it being impossible, or not impossible, but not really obvious, the path to prosecute this really is violation of the most foundational norm of the international legal order, the prohibition on the use of force, is a real issue. And speaking as somebody who's working in a law school and, you know, as are many of my colleagues, and working with students and teaching them about international law and the value of international law and the importance of international law, this is a real challenge. I don't know how others have had their students react, but when Russia invaded Ukraine, I mean, we basically had our students turn to us and say, like, what's going on? This is like the big prohibition, right? So how's the international community going to deal with this? Like, what's the point of the law? And this is why it's so important to try and find some kind of path forward on this, because we cannot just witness such important international norms being trampled on and do nothing about it. I mean, it really devalues international law and belief in international law. So I think the kind of avenues that I think Rebecca was gesturing towards, and I know Jennifer's recently written about, you know, possible solutions for trying to deal with this crime of aggression in particular, are really important.
Well, why don't we talk about some of those possible avenues? Jennifer Tran, would you like to start?
Sure. So we are where we are, and the International Criminal Court doesn't have jurisdiction. So I think there are two challenges. One is, what do you do about the instant situation? And two is, how do you fix this for the future? So how do you fix this for the future? More states that are parties to the International Criminal Court need to ratify the amendment on the crime of aggression. That increases the court's jurisdiction. Additionally, states are due for a review of the issue of jurisdiction. In 2010, they said we would have this 7 years after activation of the decision. It's due 2025. So to do anything at the UN in 2025, you actually start now. So in the future, if countries actually believe in this crime, and I think the events we're witnessing suggest that they all should believe on the imperative of this crime, which at Nuremberg was called the supreme international crime, because it differs only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. That's from the judgment. And it's, if you don't have the aggression, you don't get to all the war crimes that we're seeing. So I hope in the future we fix this issue. But where we are right now is, can we have adjudication regarding the crime of aggression in this case? And there are basically at least two proposals that seem to be out there. We have the British academics and officials suggesting this kind of Nuremberg model. We'll pool domestic jurisdictions. There's another suggestion that we follow the precedent of the Cambodia Tribunal, Sierra Leone Special Court, and have a tribunal negotiated between the UN and Ukraine, and the General Assembly could recommend this. And I think the latter is definitely the right approach. It's the multilateral approach. We have a lot of hypocrisies of the British that went into Gulf War with the United States under very flimsy legal theory, saying, oh, let's try Russia for the crime of aggression. So we have all kinds of optics problems. So I think we really need to do it correctly, which would be a multilateral approach. And it also gets us away from some immunities questions that we would have at the domestic level, and you might have if you pool domestic jurisdictions.
Do you still have immunities when you use, for example, universal jurisdiction?
Potentially, yes, you do at the domestic level. And we have this ruling when the Sierra Leone Special Court wanted to try then President Charles Taylor, later ex-president by the time they tried him. And the court ruled that for a hybrid or international tribunal, the immunities fall. So I think it's very important that we do aggression prosecutions in the future at the International Criminal Court. or at some kind of hybrid tribunal that now could be created along the model that has been tried and tested and worked fairly well in the past, at least in the Sierra Leone context.
Gaborana, what do you think of this idea? Is this the way to go?
I'm 100% on board with Jennifer's view, which is the right way to go. I think a Nuremberg-style tribunal would be a bad idea, exactly for the reasons that Jennifer said, and the reasons that Nuremberg has been subject to criticism throughout post-Nuremberg history, that it's an example of victor's justice. The winners got together to put the losers on trial. So an effort that instead comes from the entire community of nations is represented by the General Assembly and done in conjunction with the domestic authority that Ukraine can lend to the process, which is perfectly reasonable because we're talking about crimes that occurred on Ukrainian soil. That method of putting the architects of this war on trial is I think, much preferable. One thing I did just want to add by way of clarification, I want to hope and make sure that listeners are all aware that now we're talking just about the crime of aggression. As Rebecca said, the decision of going to war in the first place, which is a leadership crime. And that's the one that the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction over in this case. The ICC definitely does have jurisdiction over the broad spectrum of war crimes that are being committed and that have been committed in Ukraine, because Ukraine has recognized the competence of the International Criminal Court.
And also because of the targeted civilians, right?
Well, the war crimes themselves, including it, you know, it's almost as if Vladimir Putin looked at the Geneva Conventions and said, are there any crimes that I haven't committed yet? Let's make sure that we commit them. The targeting of civilians, attacking cultural objects, conducting attacks that are on what so-called dangerous forces, Chernobyl, conducting attacks that are indiscriminate, deportation. You know, ever since the end of the Second World War, and as a result of the Holocaust, the Geneva Conventions have prohibited the deportation of civilians, say, under occupation, out of their homeland. There are, I think, credible reports that is happening as well. Hostage taking, arbitrary detention, inhumane treatment of detainees. I think the list goes on. And these are all crimes that are not only within the general jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, but that the ICC can take cognizance of, and investigations are already underway to determine whether or not these crimes have occurred, if so, who's responsible for them. And the very important aspect of war crimes is that there is a theory called command responsibility, which means that not only the individuals who, say, conduct the torture or who drop the bomb on an apartment building are responsible, but anyone and everyone up the chain of command, not only who gives the order, but those who either knew or should have known that these violations were taking place. This notion of command responsibility is well settled in international law. It's well settled in the Rome Statute for the ICC. And so even if the ICC can't prosecute Vladimir Putin for aggression, it's entirely conceivable that criminal responsibility for these war crimes goes all the way up the chain of command to the Kremlin.
And what happens to immunity in the ICC?
No immunity in the ICC, period. Okay.
So that's the one place where immunity gets wiped out.
Correct.
So let me just first remind listeners that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about war crimes and crimes against humanity and crimes of aggression and ways to adjudicate international law and international crime that occurs in these cases. Okay, so let's talk about the ICC for a moment then, because there are a lot of criticisms about it. And the structure of it, of course, can sometimes be problematic about who can be prosecuted and who has jurisdiction and who gets justice. So why don't we talk about the strengths and weaknesses of the ICC versus one of these tribunals, for example? And why don't you, since you've got the microphone on now, Gaborana, why don't you start and then we'll bring in the others?
For the prosecution of war crimes, I think the International Criminal Court is by far the most competent and credible mechanism. That's not to say that the International Criminal Court is necessarily the first stop on the road to justice. In fact, it is by definition not the first stop. The ICC only takes cases when states themselves that are responsible to prosecute these cases are either unwilling or unable to do so. Now, it turns out that in connection with violations of the Geneva Conventions, and in particular, those violations that the Geneva Conventions call grave breaches, every country on earth has not only the right, but the responsibility to search for and to either put on trial or to extradite for trial anyone they find who has committed these grave breaches. So for war crimes in general, the first line of accountability is domestic law, and often using this notion of universal jurisdiction, that even if the crime isn't committed on your territory, even if the accused isn't your national, you have not only a right, but an obligation to put that individual on trial. The problem is that a lot of states have not implemented these requirements into their national law. Culprit number one, I would say, in that regard is the United States of America.
Used to have the Alien Tort Statute, but doesn't anymore, really, to this effect.
Yeah, that's civil responsibility, not criminal responsibility.
That's a good point, yes.
And so I have a great deal of discomfort when I hear, thankfully, that the United States supports the notion of international justice and action by the International Criminal Court for these violations in Ukraine. But it's still a case of hypocrisy because the United States itself refuses to become party to the International Criminal Court and even has objected to it for reasons that would make it impossible for the ICC to prosecute Russia if the US objections were to be absorbed. Namely, the US says, well, we're not a party to the International Criminal Court, therefore you can't put Americans on trial. And this came up in Afghanistan. Well, if that's the case, then the ICC wouldn't be able to put Russians on trial, even though they committed their crimes on the territory of a state that has recognized ICC jurisdiction. So a number of countries, including the US, I think need to get their houses in order in order to cleanly be able to advocate for international justice.
Rebecca Hamilton.
Thanks, Gabor, because you said something in talking about the US position, which is on many of these issues, also the Russian position, that I think brings us back to the question of head of state immunity at the International Criminal Court. Because while it is the case that for a state that has joined the International Criminal Court, or this is maybe a slightly more contentious proposition, but one that I believe in, when the UN Security Council has referred a situation to the International Criminal Court, under those situations, head of state immunity is not going to apply. However, it is the current position of the United States government as well as the Russian government that the International Criminal Court cannot prosecute its nationals because they are not party to the court. And that would mean, of course, Putin is a Russian national. And so it's not clear yet that the ICC could actually prosecute him. But I do think, you know, in terms of the great value of the ICC is that it is a permanent court. This is exactly, you know, after Nuremberg, the hope had been that we would have a permanent International Criminal Court. And everything got sort of frozen in the Cold War period. And the resurgence of the idea didn't happen again until the 1990s. And we had these ad hoc international criminal tribunals developed for the former Yugoslavia, for Rwanda, hybrid tribunals after that. All of them were essentially a proof of concept to show that we could do international criminal justice. But it is inefficient to set up a new court for each conflict. it's inefficient as a matter of financial resources, but it's also inefficient in terms of institutional knowledge building that you gain over the course of multiple investigations over a sustained period of time. And the ICC has been operational now, has been doing cases, has the expertise, it is under-resourced, but it is the right place to go for doing these prosecutions when there isn't a domestic forum. And I used to work at the ICC in the prosecution division, and one of the things that the prosecutor always said at the top of every speech was that success for the ICC would be if we had no cases, because all of them were being prosecuted at the domestic level. States were taking on their own responsibilities to prosecute these crimes. And it's only when states are unwilling or unable, as is the case in Ukraine at the moment, to actually do so because they're in the midst of conflict, that one needs to turn to the ICC.
So, Rebecca, just want to ask one more thing about the ICC in this context, which is, yes, it is permanent, and yes, it has all of these advantages in that way, but isn't it also mired in sort of structural and political problems as well? It's been kind of criticized for, you know, concentrating on some states and not others and these kinds of things, and the way things get referred to the ICC and, you know, what it can actually take on as a result. Talk to some of those criticisms.
Yeah, there are several really important criticisms out there, but I think framing it all up, it's important to understand that the ICC is a mirror of where states are at in the international legal system. It's often pointed out that the ICC does not have its own enforcement mechanism. It doesn't have a police force. It relies on states to do that heavy lifting. And it is a reflection of, I think, deep structural racism within the international system, that we have had the international court finding it easier to get help from states when they are prosecuting cases against African defendants. And so it's not that the ICC is blameless in this scenario. It needs to push back against taking the politically easier route. But at the same time, it's hypocritical for state actors to be casting aspersions on the ICC without looking at how they've got their own house in order. I think it would be great independently for people who are facing just horrendous atrocities in Ukraine, and they're sort of the first order of concern here, but for the perception of the court to show that it can conduct a prosecution against defendants who are in Europe, it would be a sign of maturity, I think, of the court.
Kate McIntosh, what do you think we're missing in this conversation that we need to understand, not just necessarily about Ukraine and Russia, but about this process, about, you know, justice in the international sphere? What would you add?
Well, maybe two things. One is thinking about the role of the ICC, and I fully support what the colleagues have said about that. The International Criminal Court has the most legitimacy. It's important for it to be seen to be relevant and responding to the major threats that we're facing and to atrocity crimes that are being committed. But it's never going to prosecute more than a handful of cases in any situation. And that's not just a question of resources, although it certainly is a question of resources. It's also a question of, you know, what's the purpose of these kind of justice efforts, and, you know, how do they contribute to peace, reconciliation, the rebuilding of a society, and so on. And all of the conflicts where we've seen international prosecutions have been accompanied by domestic prosecutions, you know, subsequently, when the countries reached the state that they could carry out their own prosecutions. And those have been hugely important. And if we look, for example, I mean, the situation in Rwanda and in the former Yugoslavia has been referred to. Those were, of course, the first two international courts since World War II that were set up. And they were able to deal with, you know, nearly 200 indictments each one. So they dealt with a significant number of cases, but they were very far from the forum, the situation, the country that had been through the war and the genocide. And that was a huge issue. And more meaningful, perhaps, for the societies that had been through that conflict were the prosecutions that unfolded locally. And I think that's something that the international community also needs to support. And I think we can imagine looking ahead that something like that may unfold in Ukraine. You know, that's really important. If we think about justice, the restorative value of justice obviously is crucial, is the potential of that is so much greater when it's happening near, you know, in the country itself, when it's being run by the country, when the victims, not just the victims, when the population in general are really able to observe and be engaged with that process. And that's a sort of structural problem that the International Criminal Court, you know, will always face. And of course, it does put effort into outreach and to bringing the impact of its cases home. But I think that's something to think about. So we can imagine, you know, the International Criminal Court ideally trying those most responsible at the top of the pyramid, which is exactly what it should be doing. But in terms of thinking about Ukraine and how Ukraine recovers from this, and maybe even Russia, you know, a hell of a lot more is going to have to happen at that local level in terms of trying these international crimes.
You're speaking to things that are very dear to me and right to my heart. So I really appreciate that. I want to actually talk more about that before we go down that path. I want to just check with Jennifer Trahan, see what you think we need to add to this discussion.
Sure. I'll just expand maybe a little where Kate left off. She talked about the International Criminal Court doesn't prosecute that many in any one situation country. So it goes for the most senior individuals in the worst crime scene. So this definitely leaves a role for national jurisdictions. And I believe already 10 or so have opened investigations into war crimes or the crime of aggression or other laws. Let me add one other maybe little acknowledged, little known aspect of the work of the International Criminal Court. Kate and I were privileged to work on a group called the Council of Advisors on the application of the Rome Statute to cyber warfare. And we talked about how cyber technology can be part of the commission of war crimes and part of crime of aggression. And when I've talked to some Ukrainians on panels, and you know, we're talking about the aggression this spring, they say, no, that's not when it began. This started in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea. And if you see it in that context, then you start to think of 2014 election manipulation by cyber and cyber attacks on the electric grid in 2015, 2016, NotPetya in 2017, and all the cyber attacks this spring. And you start to see how cyber is a new way that warfare is being waged. And the International Criminal Court can bring these prosecutions. The report that we came out with concluded that cyber is simply a new tool, and it's inherently in all of the International Criminal Court's crimes. So there's kind of an interesting additional angle that I think we have for the International Criminal Court that maybe isn't yet out there in the public dialogue that much.
Gabarana, I think you also have worked in the area of cyber and in particular responsibility to protect and respect. What would you add to that?
That there's been some discussion in general about the relationship between cyber activities and international law for some time now. I think the question of whether or not the traditional aspects of international law that apply to individual criminal responsibility, war crimes, human rights law, state responsibility, the questions about whether or not those realms of international law apply to cyber have been put to bed. And the answer is pretty resoundingly yes. Of course, the question remains then, well, exactly how do these international legal regimes apply to cyber? Now, just sticking with the context of the law of war and war crimes, the notion of war crimes, a large part of it anyway, is predicated on the concept of an attack. An attack is either valid or it's invalid. So then that raises the question of, well, can you construe a cyber attack to be the kind of attack that was under consideration when states got together and wrote the Geneva Conventions? It may not be entirely clear, but I think the weight of international expert opinion is that if a cyber attack has the type of effects of kinetic harm that dropping a bomb has, then it's just as much covered by the same aspects of international law, and in this case, war crimes law, international criminal law, as if it were dropping a bomb. So that may make the difference between, well, would it be a war crime to conduct a cyber attack that, you know, closes down a stock market? I don't know. Would it be a war crime to conduct a cyber attack that closes down the operation of a hospital? You bet it would. But these are the kinds of questions that have arisen in connection with cyber.
When we come back, prosecution is one part of the equation, but what about redressing the millions of survivors and victims of these crimes? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Prosecuting those who commit crimes against humanity or war crimes is only one part of achieving justice. The other part is redressing the victims and the survivors. What can be done to redress them? And why are so many still unredressed? Joining us are four experts. Jennifer Trahan is a professor and director of the Concentration in International Law and Human Rights at NYU Center for Global Affairs and is the author of Existing Legal Limits to the Use of the Veto in the Face of Atrocity Crimes. Barbara Rana is a professor at Cardozo Law School and the author of State Responsibility to Respect, Protect, and Fulfill Human Rights Obligations in Cyberspace. Rebecca Hamilton is a professor at American University, Washington College of Law, and co-author of Social Media Platforms in International Criminal Investigations. Kate McIntosh is the inaugural executive director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA School of Law, and is the author of How Long Until the Planet's Destruction is an International Crime. Let me talk about the selective prosecution that we may be seeing. Now, I know this, you know, the attack on Ukraine is so huge that that's one of the big factors. Obviously, Russia has taken Crimea. Then there was the South Ossetia that had happened before with Georgia. And just a couple of years ago, Azerbaijan and Turkey, you know, attacked Nagorno-Karabakh and ethnically cleansed that area and committed some atrocities, according to the reports that we've gotten. Of course, Syria was a horrific example of war, but that was internal, right? Civil war. And so I wonder, we're paying a lot of attention to this. Is it because of the large scale of this attack and the degree of the attack? Although, you know, Syria did produce a gargantuan loss as well. How do we make sense of this? Why do we as an international community pay attention to some and not to others? Why don't we start with Jennifer Trahan?
Well, first, we shouldn't. I mean, I'm utterly alarmed by Ukraine, but that doesn't mean I don't support all of the other international criminal court investigations and cases. And I do think, you know, victims in other situations, some of my students, I had an African student say, why are you paying so much attention to Ukraine? Well, I guess my answer is, I think it's appropriate to pay this much attention, but we must not only pay attention when Russia violates the law. I also feel a very mixed feelings when states have this outpouring of additional funding for the court, and some states want to earmark it to the Ukraine investigation. Some are a little more clever and say, oh, it's unearmarked, but we just happen to be giving it now. All of this is a little problematic. You just need to support the court more broadly and all of its cases, because we do run into just way too much hypocrisy. You cited a number of instances that have just totally escaped justice. Now, it's not the International Criminal Court's fault. It doesn't have jurisdiction over, for instance, Syria. So we can't blame the court. We could actually blame Russia for that, because the Security Council was going to send that case to the International Criminal Court, and Russia vetoed it. And I have a whole book on abusive vetoes. I know that's not our topic here today,
You could talk about it. Feel free to introduce those.
A book when, you know, something like if genocide's happening in the same way you wouldn't expect the Security Council to issue a resolution endorsing genocide. Well, if genocide's occurring and there's a plan to stop it and it's vetoed, you're actually endorsing the continued commission of genocide. And this is essentially what happened in Syria, except regarding war crimes and crimes against humanity, when Russia blocked condemnation of crimes, referral to the International Criminal Court, all these measures designed to prevent chemical weapons use, and Russia blocks them, and then it blocks humanitarian assistance. This is total abuse of the veto, and my book has some kind of technical legal arguments to actually challenge this and go to the International Court of Justice and argue, you know, this is an abuse of the veto power. And I think in hindsight, I wish I'd also covered the crime of aggression in my book, because we this spring had Russia's veto of the condemnation of its own aggression. And of course, what we won't be talking about in this radio show is the UN Security Council doing anything related to Ukraine. We won't be talking about the UN Security Council setting up an ad hoc tribunal for aggression. So when you have a P5 involved in a situation or allied closely with the country at issue, the UN Security Council, designed to maintain international peace and security, is completely paralyzed.
This seems to be one of the big flaws in the construction of this system, is the Security Council, and with the permanent members on it who, you know, are not necessarily the best citizens when it comes to human rights and upholding international law. I want to just turn to something that Rebecca and Kate brought up, which is the, you know, millions of survivors or victims of these international crimes, like war crimes. And so much of prosecution focuses on holding the perpetrators accountable. But what about redressing all of these people who have lost, you know, in some cases, their livelihoods or their lives or their family members or their limbs or whatever, you know, some are tortured? What are the biggest barriers to justice for redressing the real losers in this, the people who have either completely lost their lives or the survivors who have lost everything else? Rebecca, would you like to start?
I think that a holistic answer to that has to go beyond criminal law. A criminal law is just one sort of tool, and it can be extremely useful for getting accountability from individual perpetrators, but it is completely insufficient on its own to address the problem that you're identifying. You know, it is true, and this was a big advance, that the International Criminal Court has a victims trust fund. There is a mechanism for reparations for victims, but that's not going to be able to address the kind of scale of trauma that we are seeing in these situations. And that is going to come from a commitment from everyone in the international community over a really long time frame. And one of my concerns, and I'm sure this is shared by everyone on the panel, is just what a short attention span we have as an international community. We're really good at paying attention right at the moment of crisis, especially if it's in the heart of Europe. But recovering from these sorts of atrocities is actually an intergenerational process. And the world moves on. I've had many, many, many years of engagement with communities in Sudan. And I think the takeaway, they got a sort of unusual degree of attention during the atrocities in Darfur, attention from the West. But even that faded over time. And the lesson that they took from that is, at the end of the day, they can only rely on themselves. And so this gets back to questions that Kate was raising of what would it look like to rehabilitate, after this destruction of all of this violence, local institutions on the justice side for accountability, but also much, much broader than that. And can we commit, can we take this moment where there seems to be this abundance of political will and concern? I want to see that stretched out over the coming decades.
Kate McIntosh.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, unfortunately, there have been plenty of situations in which the world has been able to think about this, right? something which is often referred to as transitional justice. So going beyond the actual prosecution of war crimes and so on into a more restorative justice approach. And it certainly has to be driven domestically from the society itself. But I mean, in this kind of situation, of course, we can imagine that there might be some claims against Russia. There might be some legal mechanisms which were established for compensation in the aftermath of the war. Certainly seem to be appropriate. I just wanted to circle back, if I could, to the question you put earlier, though, about why is Ukraine garnering so much attention? And because I do feel it's important just to say, you know, it, whether we call it white supremacy or racism or, you know, whatever we want to call it, I mean, it is striking, right? This is what you're referring to. It is striking the way this has got so much attention and political will. And I mean, one of the shocking disparities, which I mean, I'm absolutely delighted that it's getting the attention, the political will, and it's heartbreaking to see what's happening in Ukraine, obviously, and people fleeing Ukraine. It's very heartwarming to see the way they're being received across Europe. And we did briefly see that also for refugees fleeing Syria, actually, for a certain period of time in Europe as well, and of course led by
But them. Not the same attention in terms of the legal approaches and analysis and how do we fix this? That was missing with Syria.
Yeah, and we're seeing, you know, that refugees from Ukraine wonderfully are being accepted and being given, you know, 3 years to enter and to stay in European countries at exactly the same time that refugees trying to reach from Syria, from Yemen, from Afghanistan, you know, are being from sub-Saharan Africa are being turned away in the most brutal and inhumane fashion, often in violation of international law. And it's such a stark contrast. I think we probably all share a real discomfort about what that's saying about our profession, our community, our society.
So do you think that what you're referring to then as maybe the biggest barrier is race, racism, to getting justice for the survivors and victims of these types of things?
I don't know if I could say that racism is the biggest barrier, because I think
one of them.
These are very complex situations with different factors at play. But I do think that the, you know, very positive response to the tragedy that's happening in Ukraine, to the international crimes that are being committed in Ukraine, has thrown up the contrast with the lack of attention paid to countries where the victims are not white Europeans. And I don't think we can turn away from that.
Yeah, this is Rebecca just jumping in. I'm very comfortable saying outright that it's racism, not racism in the imputation of individual explicit bias, but the racism that is structurally built into a very international order. And that is not something that has happened overnight. This is longstanding, and it is going to be a longstanding and again, intergenerational project to work on the reform of that. And part of that is going to need to come through looking at what is the setup at the UN Security Council as well.
So let me just first remind listeners that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about war crimes and crimes against humanity and crimes of aggression and ways to adjudicate international law and international crime that occurs in these cases. So this is obviously a project that I'm quite interested in terms of survivors and victims, as opposed to prosecutions, right? And I know we've been talking about the prosecutions as the main thing, but that doesn't always translate into them feeling like they've gotten any kind of justice. So, Gabo, what are your thoughts on this? Like, what do you see as the barriers here?
I entirely agree with my colleagues about the hypocrisy of the West in how it distinguishes between this conflict and other situations of mass atrocity. I would also add that there are also some differences between Russia invading Ukraine and some of the other situations of mass atrocity that have gotten less international attention. This attack by a permanent member of the Security Council on a sovereign state has generated condemnation from the entire General Assembly, save five states. So it's not just the West that's complaining. And I think the reason for that and the difference between this and some of the previous situations of mass atrocity that have gained less international attention is that this shakes the notion of an international rule-based order to its core. I can speak maybe more critically about the United States than I would some other countries because I'm an American, so I feel more comfortable in saying, well, you know, the U.S. has engaged in wars of aggression in Iraq, for example. The U.S. has a very storied history of fomenting coups, overthrowing governments, fomenting violence in other countries. I think, though, unless I'm mistaken in my history, the United States doesn't invade other countries for the purpose of destroying their very existence as countries and for the purpose of annexing them into their own territory. This is something that is so different, I think, from other instances of aggression. And that's why it does kind of shake the notion of an international rule-based order to its core and why it generated such a significant response. In answer to your question about obstacles, I'm actually less pessimistic about the eventual opportunity to enact and exact reparations than I am about the possibility of exacting individual criminal responsibility for the architects of this aggression. The way international law stands is you got to get your hands on the guy and bring him to the trial. States, on the other hand, and in order to conduct a criminal proceeding. And there have been arguments for trials in absentia, and put that aside for the moment. But we know where states can be found, and we know how they can be found. We know that we have sanctions imposed. And when I say we, I mean the international community. Assets have been frozen. International courts like the International Court of Justice, the European Court of Human Rights, there are a number of mechanisms whose authority has already been triggered and have been extremely quick to come to the conclusion that Russia has engaged in an intolerable array of conduct that violates the laws of nations. And so I'm not so pessimistic about the eventuality of a process that creates an opportunity for reparations. Now, one last thing I want to say about reparations. I think the reason that Germany became a success after World War II, and the reason maybe Germany didn't become a success after World War I, is that in World War II, there was a Marshall Plan. And the countries that had the capacity devoted a great deal of their resources to rebuilding what was destroyed. After the Soviet Union collapsed, American kind of neocon political thought held sway to determine that our plan from now on is that no country should ever again be able to challenge the United States' power and authority. And instead of extending a hand to the development of a democratic Russia, the United States maintained kind of a Cold War mentality, even though the Soviet Union ended. So when and if the time comes to consider reparations here, certainly the vast, you know, a very significant part of the responsibility is going to be on Russian shoulders, and the mechanisms already exist to make that happen. But I think other countries are going to have to start writing some checks as well in order to reconstitute a country that used to be Ukraine.
Well, Jennifer Trahan gets the final word here because we're just about out of time, and this is the only time I'll give you pressure for being kind of concise. How would you respond to this question about redressing the survivors and the barriers to justice for them?
Absolutely. Thank you. So I have to agree with Gabor. This is kind of a critical moment for the rule of law, because the violation here was of this core norm of the UN Charter, Article 2.4. So it really challenges the international legal order. And the crime of aggression only criminalizes a manifest charter violation, like a super clear one. This is actually your perfect case. This was a super clear charter violation. The US often has some kind of flimsy legal theories or debatable legal theories, but we may not even reach that for criminal law purposes. This is really your strong case. But I agree, in terms of rebuilding Ukraine and giving money to the victims, I think one needs to think about a claims commission. You could think of all the frozen assets in US bank accounts. You could also think of Russia having to fund this, and this should be on the table in the peace negotiations, which I'm hoping will end this tragedy. But you could imagine a percentage of oil revenues going right to a reparations scheme. So I think we need to think creatively in those ways, and there is precedent for doing this.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle and for sharing your wisdom and for sharing your research and your expertise with all of us and our listeners. It's been a great pleasure hosting you. Jennifer Trahan is professor and director of the Concentration in International Law and Human Rights at NYU Center for Global Affairs. Trahan has published two digests on the case law of the ad hoc tribunals and is the author of Existing Legal Limits to the Use of the Veto in the Face of Atrocity Crimes. Barbara Rana is a professor at Cardozo Law School and the author of Is There a Way Out? Of the Non-International Armed Conflict Detention Dilemma, and also State Responsibility to Respect, Protect, and Fulfill Human Rights Obligations in Cyberspace. Rebecca Hamilton is a professor at American University, Washington College of Law, and the author of Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide, and co-author of Social Media Platforms in International Criminal Investigations. Kate McIntosh is the inaugural executive director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA School of Law. She was head of humanitarian affairs for Doctors Without Borders and is the author of How Long Until the Planet's Destruction is an International Crime? And the forthcoming, The Crime of Ecocide Through Human Rights, New Tools for Climate Justice. And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.